The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Not joined today by Stacey Patton, but I do have a special guest for us in this episode that you will meet in a second. The Knicks lost in Orlando last night. It wasn't really a game that I want to go over. I didn't really learn anything about the team from it. I still don't think it really matters that much in the big picture. Orlando's been playing very well of late. They've been one of the better second half teams this year. This isn't like losing to the Magic in most seasons. There were obviously a lot of disappointing parts of the loss. They were down 19 early, came back. There was what happened with Julius Randle, which we'll get into a little bit in this episode. But I want to focus on what I think has been the biggest story recently in the Knick universe, which is obviously the passing of Willis Reed, who is pretty universally regarded as one of the holy trinity of Knick players, along with Walt Frazier and Patrick Ewing. I have some thoughts about that I want to get into. But before I introduce our guest and before we get to the Willis Reed discussion, just a reminder, as always, that I have not yet pulled up my ad copy. So the reminder first is to make sure you pull up your ad copy before you tell the audience that you are about to pull up the ad copy. Here we go. Also a reminder that BetOnline remains your number one source for all your college basketball betting this season. Get analysis of every play, prop, and point at BetOnline. You'll find the latest odds, bracket contests, team matchups, and game trends. Updated odds for everything from live games right through to the Final Four and the championship game. BetOnline is your college basketball headquarters this season. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to sign up and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Be sure to use our promo code BELIEVE, that's BLEAV, to receive your bonus. BetOnline.ag, where the game starts. So where the pod starts, I want to introduce to you, I believe it's his first time on, on a Knick-related podcast. This is an individual who has, so I have followed the Knicks, I'm like the old man at the Strickland because I have followed the Knicks since basically 1990, which is like 30-something years, which is not bad at all. But This man has watched the Knicks since, I'm guessing, before Willis, certainly followed them since before Willis Reed was even there. To those of you who names like Johnny Green and Tom Gola and Eddie Donovan mean anything, this person was there for those years, Carl Braun as head coach. The prehistoric Knicks, and I say that with all love and affection. He has seen it all. He has seen basically the franchise from start till now. And I wanted to have him on specifically because I think a lot of the people who listen to this show are around my age or younger. We never saw Willis Reed play. And I wrote two pieces this week about Reed, one for Posting and Toasting, and the Strickland will come out, I think, this weekend. And I felt myself really wanting to go in a direction. There's like a Willis Reed tradition. We all know it. You mentioned Willis Reed, it's game three. It's 1970. It's coming down the tunnel. And this is not to minimize like the magic of those moments, but there's so much more to the man and his career and his meaning than what I think he's been kind of caricaturized as. And it's not the worst caricature to have, but I wanted to get to talk to someone who actually knows Willis Reed as a career, not as a, I don't know, a token from the past. So also, I believe this is our first guest on this show who has ever actually played at Madison Square Garden. So very excited to introduce to the pod for the first time, Edgar Miranda. It's not no relation. It is a relation. He's my father, Edgar Miranda. Bapi, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Matt. Thank you for this is a special night. I'm really excited to be here. This is pretty cool. So thanks for bringing me in.
Yeah. Very excited to have you on. So I mentioned at the start however you want to rank it, generally speaking, when people talk Knick players in history, it's Reed and Frazier and Ewing. One thing that really is different about Reed versus the other two, you know, Patrick Ewing came in with about as much fanfare as anyone has ever come to the Knicks with, and Walt Frazier, not quite that level, but he was a top five, I think, top five, top six picks, had put on, I think, a good showing in the NIT. With Southern Illinois. Willis Reed did not come in like that. Willis Reed was a second round pick out of Grambling. This is when the draft had 10 players instead of 30. But still, it was the second round because there were 10 teams. Willis Reed was not drafted to be what he became. I'm curious, right before Willis Reed got there, their best player was probably Johnny Green. What do you remember about... Here's this guy, here's this Willis Reed, here's this player from Grambling, doesn't come in. I'm guessing back then that most young players came in with less hype than they do now anyway. And Reed in particular probably was not a huge name. Do you remember when you started noticing or recognizing that, oh, this Willis Reed, this guy is a player, like this is someone that I'm going to pay some attention to?
I have to say, I probably started paying more attention to him when the team started getting a little bit better. I mean, I recall one of the first things that I heard about the Knicks, I think, is when I learned the word mediocre. I had a phys ed teacher when I was in junior high school, and he was teaching us some basketball drills in gym, and he always used to put the Knicks down, and he said, they're just mediocre. They're just mediocre. And so I really didn't hear very much. I followed the Knicks because they were New York. Honestly, I can't tell you really remembering anything significant about the draft or Reed coming on. I mean, I know you heard a little bit more about him when he was playing alongside Bellamy, and it was kind of awkward. That's what I remember because it was like you sort of had two big men, and it didn't work out all that well. And I think he sort of started coming out a little bit more after Bellamy left. Mm-hmm. But I you think about it right now, how he came in many ways, I think is how he distinguished himself throughout the career. It was quiet, but effective. He was a quiet, forceful leader. He was a great athlete, obviously, but I think what stood out most about him wasn't necessarily like some others, the physical skill. But I think there was that presence. And that's what started, I think, coming out more and more. And especially as that team began to evolve into a team, the team that hit its peak, obviously, in 69, that's when you really began to appreciate that trait about him. I think his leadership, his quiet leadership.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, as I said, I was thinking about some of these things earlier about, we talk about great players, usually has to do with physical ability. You talk, obviously, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Kobe and even Clyde.
Clyde was a big guard.
Yeah. But like I said, with Reed, yes, he was a great athlete, but that's not what I think made him so special. I just think it was that presence. I think he made the other guys around him better. I don't know what was the quote, some quote about someone saying that they didn't recall any kind of a meeting or anything where, Red Holzman said that, they were going to name Reed the captain. He was the captain. He always was the captain. Mm-hmm. It was just, that's it. He was the man.
And it's interesting. If you look over Reed's career, like you're saying, the first thing that strikes you about him is just this sense of there's an adult in the room. Like, here's the captain. Here's a person in charge. That's basically there, like you're saying, from the start. Not only Reed was named captain, I think, before the 1966 season, when he's 24 years old. That's unusual to have a guy that can be the captain. And his first year, like the year Reed was drafted, he kind of comes out of nowhere from Grambling. He plays 80 games. He plays 38 minutes a game. He's an all-star. He's rookie of the year. And I this is going to come out in the Strickland piece I wrote about. I think after the season, when he met with ownership to go over his contract, he wanted to make more than he either wanted a bigger salary or a bigger bonus than someone who was ahead of him on the roster. And the team wasn't budging on it. And Reed, and you read a lot of stories about this with him, like the combination of wisdom and confidence and strength. He just stood up and told them, all right, I'm going to show you. He dropped it. He's I'm going to show you, and it's going to cost you more. And it did. And they were happy to pay it. But this is not a time. This is not. Who was just Reed? Who's a recent high draft pick? This is not. Luka Doncic knows at his age, I have this much power. This is a time where players don't have free agency. This is a time where. There's the great story about when the players in 1964 were going to hold out, they were going to strike during the All-Star game. It was going to be on TV. The NBA was enormously invested in this finally getting on television. And right as the game was going to start, the players had held a meeting and decided, we're going to basically tell them, if you don't agree to meet with us and go over these issues, we're not playing. And Elgin Baylor was in the locker room. The players literally locked themselves in the locker room. And there was a security guard outside the door. The Lakers owner comes to the door and basically shows the guard the way, and he tells the guard, tell Baylor, to get out here. And Baylor, from inside the lock, I can't remember the Lakers owner's names, but Baylor says, tell so-and-so to go fuck himself. Mm. And that was an amazing, that's become a legendary story because the power dynamic was so different between labor and ownership then. When Willis Reed is standing up and behaving this way, and it wasn't controversial or volatile, but the confidence of a first year player to tell an owner at that point in this labor history, all right, you're going to pay me more, you're going to see it, and to have that confidence and then deliver on it, just stands out to you as this isn't just another dude. This is anyone who's played sports, you see sometimes people who just he's got it, he's on it. Follow him.
We'll yeah, good. When I talk about something physical, there's something about the personality, there's something about the character of someone like that, that again, at that age, has that kind of poise and has that kind of vision and perspective. He's gonna maintain his dignity, and he's gonna be strong, and he's gonna be quiet, and he's gonna be forceful about it. And I think that kind of behavior sometimes puts out a really powerful message. And I have no doubt that probably during the course of the time he's with the Knicks, and when things were coming down with the Knicks and they were having, whatever conversations in the locker room at a game or some other thing, that when he spoke, people listened. because there was substance and there was strength in this man, and there was I think also integrity, and I think that goes along with it. I mean, you know, one of the things, you know, it kind of made me feel like I come from, you know, that I used to watch, what is it, Nesmith play?
Nesmith. With the peach baskets.
Yeah,
I
never saw him play. He retired a couple of years before I started following the game. But you have a lot of guys now, it's all about me. Even leaders on a team, it's all about me, and it always comes out as being, I mean.
To the point of not only on the court in terms of play or within the organization, but in a few cases, not everybody has this amount of clout yet. But, you know, LeBron James, for example, he is his team's leader every single year. He is directly responsible for it. Trade that guy, bring this guy in, draft that guy. Like, I've always thought it has to be a different world now for that not to be incredibly awkward. And it is a different world because there's not the loyalty / ownership that there was in the past. But yeah, Reed, there's a difference there.
Yeah. And I mean, some people may disagree because of physical skills or whatever, but I still, if we could have some kind of a time machine, if we brought back that Knicks team that really was sort of centered around this man, I still think that they would run circles around a lot of things because it was a machine. It was team play. Now you have, you know, maybe like one or two superstars on the team. The Knicks had guys on that squad who were superstars, but when they became part of that team, it was a unit. Mm-hmm. You know, Clyde, any other place, would be an outstanding star or whatever. I mean, Earl the Pearl, before he came to them, and he was with the Bullets, same thing. Mm-hmm. And then
the Busher was an all-star three years with Detroit before he got to the Knicks.
But they all bought into, I think it's just one of those things. I think, it was Reed, but it also was Holzman. I mean, I think the two of them, I think, were like a match made in heaven. And they offered something that guys with a lot of skills and a lot of ego bought into. I mean, that, as you were saying, the Busher, Bradley, Frazier, Monroe, Barnett. It was team. It wasn't star first. It was team first. And I think a lot of that was stuff that I think Reed modeled.
And I think I just thought of this tonight. I think there's a modern example, and I think it parallels not only that it's two great big men who could have done much more on an individual level if they wanted to. But in each case, like from year one, I had never thought of this till now, but there's a player who, much more recent than Reed, entered the league kind of similar. Like, I mean, came in with much more hype. He was the top pick in the draft, but immediate all-star, but not a guy who like was about the scoring, was certainly not about flash, did not. His numbers were almost identical for like his entire career. Everyone knew like this guy could win MVP every year if he wanted to put up the number. He didn't do it. And he had that same also intangible, just he came to a veteran team. Unlike Reed came to a young team and it built around him. This guy came to a veteran team and immediately led them to a title. And it was Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan was a player who dignified, had this quality to him, made his teammates better, not by playing better himself. And I when I watch Reed for some of the pieces that I've done and some pieces in the past, I haven't seen, I didn't see him play for years. But even just going from never having seen him play to watching 5 or 6 games and seeing the skill, not just of him, like I really encourage to anyone listening who hasn't done this, especially if you're not of that time, watch some of the games, like the old games. If you watch game 7 of the Knicks Lakers in 1970, there's a play in the late third, early fourth where Wilt Chamberlain does something that ends up as a dunk that is astonishing to see today. Like, nobody in Wilt's time, like, you watch that game, you get a sense of like what athleticism was, what strength was. You can see Will Chamberlain is a different, he's an alien physically compared. And that's another thing with Reed. That's who Reed's going up against. Like, Reed is not guarding exclusively. Like, Wes Unseld is an undersized, like, center. But Reed has made, you know, Hall of Fame memories out of defending Will Chamberlain, out of defending Lou Alcindor, out of defending going up against Bill Russell, at least at the end of, you know, still for, like, maybe the last 5 years of Russell's career. That's who he's going up against. And like I told you earlier when we spoke, he's not just... He put in a good shift, like, good for him. He's winning all defense doing that. He takes on whatever and excels at it, you know? Yeah. And I feel like that's a reflection of, if you read about his parents and you read about, he grew up on his 200-acre farm and they had a certain sense of, like, how things were done. And I feel like, you know how cars now, you can tell when you, you know, cars now are shit. Like, they run better and they do a lot of things nicely, but they're kind of plasticky. They're kind of, if you feel an old car in terms of the construction or an old piece, like a desk or a table that was meant to last 150 years, there's just a difference qualitatively to it. And I feel like Reed, and they just talked about this in the Knicks game a couple nights ago, Mitchell Robinson, who's a center today, who is, I don't know, 24, you know, he never came close to seeing. He said that when he was a rookie, Reed came to him at a Knick practice and spoke to him. And I told him, they were both from Louisiana. Reed talked to him about his game and, like, really pumped him up and gave him confidence. And Mitchell Robinson is saying now, all these years later, that, like, that was the most significant conversation that he had. That's remarkable, because you will hear a lot of older players complaining the younger players aren't interested in us. They don't listen. Klein has complained that none of the Knick players ever, like, come to him. You know, the guards never ask, you know, they don't look for anything from him. Willis Reed, that's just another example of that, whatever it is.
Well, but I think there's an old, you know, a commonly used expression, but, you know, saying character counts. And I think that that's something that people find very appealing, and it, you know, with the younger players I could see, would I really going to value hearing from somebody who has demonstrated over the years of having character and strength. And it's, you know, again, it's something you see in other sports. I mean, there, you mentioned Tim Duncan, but I think of, you know, in other athletes who also have distinguished themselves, not only being great athletes, but being great human beings. You know, all of this stuff, and I say this, you know, that I spent a lot of years in education, but more and more, I think the success people have in life has everything to do with their human relation skills. You know, someone who comes to who is extremely gifted, but then is also extremely humble and willing to share, that's going to bring out a lot of admiration from others. And it's going to put much more credibility in the things that they say, because that's an individual who could have made the choice to become much more egocentric and much more, flashing how they, you know, like to carry themselves, like, you know, but they don't do that. They choose to, like you said before, like a Duncan or even, I always say to a certain extent, even like a Bill Russell, they were strong.
Yeah,
but they had character, and I think that for me is the thing. I one of the things that I always used to love about Reed, he was strong, but he was a person of character, a leader of character.
All of which made a story that I read today that I had never heard before very bizarre. I was reading some of the old...
He also had a temper, but we won't talk about it.
He may have.
I did see the video. My father had never seen the video.
The now famous, maybe minute-long video of Willis Reed single-handedly going Rambo on the Lakers.
You ever seen one of those? You ever seen one of those machines when they're doing the tar on a roadway? It just rolls. I mean, that's what there was one part of it where he just, like, rolled over three. I think it was like three guys.
Yeah,
we were
the bench. Yeah, he did.
It was like he was smoothing out the tar at the Garden or wherever it is that they were playing that night. It was I had not seen it until today, and I thought it was pretty. I've never seen that before. I mean, he just laid it out, and he didn't start it, but he finished it.
That's the thing. Don't start none, won't be none.
Right.
If you want a little evidence of karma, Jerry West in that clip, if you just Google Willis Reed like fights the Lakers, you'll find it. Jerry West mentioned that there were three different Lakers who got their nose broken by Willis Reed. And that segues into the story that I have never heard before that I have found really, really bizarre. Reed had to retire in 1974 because he had torn knee ligaments, and he was if he had surgery, it was going to be basically like 10 months before he was going to come back. And he took 10 days to think about what he was going to do. And he came back, and the Knicks wanted him back, and he came back and told them he was done. And at the I guess press conference where the Knicks talked about it, Reed wasn't there, but Holzman was. And Holzman went over. They described like all the injuries that Reed had suffered like during the time in his career. I don't have them all in front of me now, but he had multiple knee operations before he tore the ACL in 74. So even before then, shoulder sprain. I can't remember the whole list now, but like it was like a dozen different injuries to every part of his, a thigh injury, all kinds. Like the man was beaten up,
right.
Very, very beaten up. And in 74, he missed almost the whole regular season, came back late. Was not the same, was a non-factor. John Gianelli was playing more than him, like in the playoffs. That year, the Knicks players, they lost in the second round of the Celtics. They got their playoff shares. And apparently the players voted Reed a half share. And the fans and the media apparently were furious about this. I was shocked when I read that story. Now, maybe that's just, it was a different time. Different labor sensibilities. Like he really wasn't there that year at all. So even giving him a half share was more than he had been there for. And at that point, he's been in the league, you know, 10 years. He's made money relatively. But like, that's incredible.
Well, I had not heard that story before. It is, it's like, damn, the guy paid his dues. The right? guy made that franchise. And, you know, it's like, these guys don't read their history. I mean, they didn't read the history of the Knicks. They don't know who Willis Reed is. And you know, they probably got a sense of who he was and what he meant by if we got that blowback from the fans. But that's really disappointing. I'm going to take a look at who was on that roster in 74. And if there's anybody that I used to like was on that roster, I'm going to be scratching them off.
There's a couple names you might know.
Well, what do you say? Gianelli? Come on, man.
To be fair to John Gianelli, someone had to take the role that year, and it was him. We're talking about John Gianelli. Kind of related to that question. Sorry, I'm lost in my notes here for a moment. How weird. Well, I guess the last thing I want to ask you about. Oh, I wanted to. That's what I wanted to see. Another story that if you don't get to see the Knick games, you wouldn't know this. The day that Reed passed away, they played in Miami, and Walt Frazier did the game with Mike Breen. So Breen was asking him, you know, a lot of questions, and memories are coming up for Clyde. Frazier said, and I did not know this, that the year Frazier was traded, Reed was the Knicks head coach, and he said that the rest of his life, all the time that they knew each other and got together and talked, he said they never once spoke about that. And I wanted to try to get a sense of, was there any feeling at the time of, because Willis Reed is not the general manager, he's not the front office, but he's kind of in the front office. Was there any awkwardness or at the time, like, controversy to the fact that Frazier was traded while Reed was the head coach?
I don't recall hearing anything. I just recall that I think a lot of us were like very disappointed that took place.
What was the rationale for trading Frazier?
I think part of it that they felt he wasn't happy, and some reason management wasn't happy with him, so they had to move him. And it's one of those things.
Okay.
But I find it interesting you said that. I mean, at least they maintained a friendship, right? They would talk to each other before a game.
Oh yeah, they did. Frazier just said that one thing they never spoke about.
He wasn't like that ball player I used to play with who we played for. Remember, I tell you, he was a pitcher. I used to be his catcher. Yes. And then I went to play for another team, and he would not talk to me. And this is semi-pro. Like, come on, man. You know, that kind of stuff just doesn't. So it was good to see that, again, the humanity remained and they talked to each other. Because sometimes, you know, competition is serious, but it shouldn't be that serious. That you can't, you know, especially after what they went through and the experiences they had. They're always going to be connected. Always.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you – I don't like this question, but it only interests me if you have an immediate answer, like immediate obvious response. Patrick Ewing Patrick Ewing generally is – what Patrick Ewing has going for him is the brilliant individual – you know, game record that he brought, and he was there longer than anybody. The numbers are enormous. And I think also Ewing, I mean, to all his credit for the other things, also like Jordan, Ewing arrived at the time where media really exploded in terms of coverage. So like we saw Patrick Ewing way more than a casual fan saw more of Ewing than you saw probably of Frazier and Reed growing up trying to watch them. Frazier, I think, is really beloved not only, you know, for his incredible, well-deserved career marks, but because he really has now become like Mr. Nick, I would say more than Marv Albert, because they got there around the same time, but Albert's been gone now 20 years. Frazier is a beloved Hall of Fame player. He's also a beloved Hall. He's in the Hall as an announcer as well. Like he's an icon in all these ways. So he's loved. And Ewing is, you know, modern and better remembered, and I think in some ways probably his individualism shines more because he played with lesser players. He's kind of victimized by that, so he's brighter for what was around him. Reed, I have always felt, until really this week studying him more, that Reed was always like the distant third, that like great, you know, had done these amazing things but had not he wasn't there as long as Ewing. And for all Reed did, in that game seven, Frazier did have 36 and 19 assists and 7 rebounds. Like, if the question to you was, who do you think, just overall, is like the greatest Nick ever? Do you have an immediate answer? Because no. I don't know if there is an answer, but I'm curious.
I thought you were gonna go in that direction with this question. Yeah. So I was already thinking about and I mean it as a serious answer. It reminds me of being a father of three kids, and somebody asks you, "Who's your favorite?"
So it's the middle one that you love the best. It's Frazier. That's what you're saying. Okay.
No, I didn't say that. Honestly, you do these comparisons between, let's say, Ewing and Reed. Mm-hmm. And you know the thing against Ewing is he never got a championship, but he didn't have the supporting cast. Well, the kind of team that Reed was able to.
Unless Reed played with more Hall of Famers in his starting lineup than Patrick Ewing played with All Stars his entire time as an actor.
And I do think, to Reed's credit, I think Reed was the type of player that elevated the other guys. But again, it was a team, so they all lifted each other up. Whereas, you know, I think about Ewing, a great player, but then you know they had some exciting guys who came through, like Starks. But Starks, I remember, would go like crazy sometimes and do things on the court that did not help the Knicks. So Ewing was great. If he had the Bushes and Fraziers and Monroes around him, they probably would have had a bunch of championships. But he didn't have that. But again, even if he did, the other thing is you have to, you know, and we've seen this, let's say, with the Yankees and other teams, that they bring all these great ball players together, but there's no chemistry. It's a disjointed thing. I think that was, again, I go back to the magic with Reed, that he was able to be that sort of that center, obviously on the court, but also within that organization, that elevated everybody's game, that kept them focused, that kept them all under control and kept them working as this machine. I mean, obviously, again, I go back, you got to give Red Holzman a lot of credit for that. But for me, I can't pull away from the Knicks of the late 60s. And so I would probably have to say, not the middle child. I would have to say Willis.
Okay. Can't go wrong with any of those answers. You certainly can't go wrong with Willis Reed.
Yeah. And I love the three of you equally too. You know that.
Well, listen, Laurie, don't listen to the show, so you can tell the truth.
Okay.
So I'll send him the tape. You mentioned Starks, and I want to. He's actually going to connect to the other part of the pod that I want to get to today, which is Julius Randle, and the issue that I don't know if it's an issue, but it's at least an issue that I want to talk about. If you saw the Orlando game, there was a right when the first half ended, Randle was frustrated, I think, with a non-call from the officials. He was saying things. The officials whistled him for a technical. Emmanuel Quickly and Josh Hart were trying to guide him back towards the bench. Quickly, had his hand on Randle, trying to guide him. When Randle, at some point, turned away from the refs, he then turned to Quickly and was whispering not sweet nothings in Quickly's face. And it wasn't a great visual, for whatever that's worth. It just wasn't, you know, a great visual. People read body language. If you're at a family reunion and you saw two people talking this way, you would make a conclusion. So that's what's going on. The reason I'm interested in this issue is there's a lot of places that this issue can go. My interest on it is kind of on this level. In my life watching the Knicks, and I am a bigger Julius Randle fan than almost anybody. Even when Randle has struggled and really been at like the bottom of his time with the Knicks, I've liked him since high school. I'm an unabashed big Julius Randle fan. I think he is one of the two most volatile Knicks that I can remember in terms of on-court how they carry themselves. Maybe I'm not thinking of someone, but to me it's John Starks and it's Julius Randle. John Starks, but so that in and of itself, that is significant. To me, if this is the most volatile player that has been a Knick in 25 years, and that player happens to be arguably the best player on the team, I would say I think he is an all NBA player. It's important. If your best player, particularly in basketball, is volatile, it matters more than it does if your third baseman is, because your best player in basketball is going to impact everything. Now, John Starks assaulted people on the court. John Starks clotheslined Scottie Pippen. John Starks headbutted Reggie Miller. John Starks told the press after a game that he wanted to cut Reggie Miller's dick off and feed it to him and make him eat it. Like, Julius Randle's not doing any of that. So I'm asking you this question specifically because I know you don't probably get to see the Knicks as much as I do. So, but it's just kind of a human issue. And I think race is also a big part of this conversation because there is the immediate cultural expectation that, and the NBA has had this tension forever. You know, its product is enormously popular with white Americans, and it is, I think, 80% at least made up of Black Americans. And sometimes there's conflict in terms of the lens that the viewer is bringing, or let me say the lens that the league and its advertisers think they should be selling to. So this conversation, there's a lot of complexities and a lot of nuance to it. And I can't pretend to know anything about Julius Randle. I'm not here to psychoanalyze him. As a fan watching the team, I don't know if I think, okay, there's an issue, because this is not the first or second or fifth time since Randle's Nick. Earlier this season, there was a game where he was getting very upset, and Tom Thibodeau literally had him in a bear hug, holding him. There was the game in Los Angeles when they played the Lakers in a national game where Randle was talking to teammates, referees, eventually arena security. He was talking to everybody. We've seen this with Randle. I don't know if the fact that if it's happened this much, it means something. To me as a fan, because if this doesn't happen, he's my favorite player. I want to see him be here the next 4 or 5 years and see what he can do. But if there's a concern that this is an issue as a fan, then you start thinking, do you want to invest in this person? Do you want to commit to this person going forward if you don't know how reliable he's going to be? We've seen game where he gets frustrated very easily. The one time he was in the playoffs 2 years ago, he was incredibly flustered by what was going on. Anyone who watches Randle, it's known he has a very low boiling point for stress, it's one of the reasons I like him so much as a person and a player. He's talked openly about this struggle. He's talked openly about, but I guess the other part of it is he hasn't done anything. He has never hurt somebody. He's never been in a physical, he's thrown an elbow, but basketball, Willis Reed attacked all the Lakers. Julius Randle has never, ever fought someone, attacked someone. He hasn't done anything out of the normal basketball player. So is there an issue? Or is there?
There is an issue. I really do think there's an issue. And I think the issue has to do with how we deal with people who have mental health issues or emotional issues, how we see them. And we've seen that be manifested in sports throughout. Sometimes it's comical. I remember watching the Mets when Jimmy Pearsall hit his 100th home run and he ran around the bases backwards. And that was a big joke. Obviously, there was some concern of why he would do that, and he's had a history already of some issues.
I didn't know that about him. I'd only ever heard the story about him running the bases backwards.
Your grandfather had a great laugh about that because we were watching the game when that took place. But then you have other athletes. The Bernard King situation is one that I find really sad. People want their sports, and I don't know. I guess it depends how far you want to look into the athlete that you're cheering for. Do you want to see him just as a thing, a performer, and you don't really care what's going on with him as a person? If you just want to see him as a performer, then obviously if he's going to be doing stuff that's going to affect how your team does, you're not going to want any, you're not going to view him in a very positive way. If you realize or accept the fact that all of these guys happy to be gifted physically, but they're also humans and subjected to some of the same imperfections that others have, then it may be a different thing. And you may view these guys with a little bit more compassion. When I see someone who speaks openly about their challenges, and then you see them when they're struggling, you hurt for the guy. Who was this other ball player, who changed his name?
Ron Artest, who became Meta World Peace, who is now, I can't remember. There's a new name now that he has.
Okay, but the point is, that's a sad situation. But people get, but how do people react?
If you remember, when he won with the Lakers, famously, spoke when they first put a microphone in front of him, in front of everybody, in front of the arena, 20,000 people, millions at home. First thing he did was thank his mental health therapist, talked about the importance and the value of that. And it had really never happened before, I don't think, publicly in the NBA like that.
Yeah. So you want, you have to wonder sometimes about putting folks in positions that may end up being too difficult for them to deal with. And you put them in a tough situation, a lot of pressure. Guys who, quote unquote, don't have mental health issues sometimes develop mental health issues because of the amount of attention that's being given to them, being so. I say the first thing that should be there as an organization is help provide the kind of support and help to get their players well, and then I think as fans, I wouldn't want him being dismissed or traded or canned because of his behavior, because we know in part that the behavior that he has is not something that he's necessarily doing intentionally. There's a problem there. So I think the humane thing is to try to be as supportive as you can of the player. Cheer for him. As hard as you cheer for him on the court, cheer for him off the court when he's struggling to get better.
I've always kind of felt this way as a fan. Like in the 90s, I remember thinking that if the Knicks could trade John Starks for Michael Jordan, I wouldn't do it because I wanted the Knicks to beat him. I didn't want it to be that way. I don't watch the Knicks, and I can say this now because they're nowhere near contending and they haven't been anywhere near contending for a long time. Yeah. But I don't watch the Knicks to see that. I'm not a fan who like needs every move to happen to push them towards a title as fast as possible. That's not why I watch them. It's not why I pay this much attention to them. So I feel like I know the organization, they're not going to run this way, but to their credit, I would say that you made the point about the organization, like, and are they there for him? And you see before games, there's a coach who will be on the bench with Randall working through breathing exercises with him. And all the time Randall has been here and all these public incidents, and you have to assume that it doesn't just happen publicly, and all the ups and downs of his time here, there has never been a single instance of a teammate who has left or anonymous off the record who has ever said anything negative about Julius Randle. I hope that in the evolution of fan-player relationship, that fans continue to grow more and more towards recognizing that these are human beings. Like, there was an article maybe a year or so ago about that mental health issues are a much larger percentage of the total, like, that it's a bigger deal in the NBA than people will ever realize, that it's like a big, big thing. And I hope as this relationship evolves between fans and players, and hopefully we keep growing towards recognizing they're not property of the owners. They're not exclusively just there to entertain us. They're actually people who have lives. On one level, it makes sense that any NBA player would struggle with mental health because the reality of their life is so bizarre. Like if you don't look at money, because we always just, you know, it's a technique. It gets us looking at each other and not where the real issues lie. Mm-hmm. You look at the money, but you don't think about, like, on a mental health level, there was a day the last year that I taught at a university, like physically before the pandemic, I hated it. It was the worst place I ever worked. And I don't need to tell you like where it is, because that's not like significant. Right. Rochester Institute of Technology. But I'm just saying that I really, really like couldn't stand being there. And there was a day I couldn't do it. And I emailed my kids and I told them, like, I am struggling with depression today. I can't stand in front of you and pretend to do it. I can't do it at all. I went to the library. I sat by a window. It was a sunny day. And I just sat there for a while and just basically hid from the world. I could do that because I'm an anonymous person who has no fame or celebrity, and most of us have that privilege. They don't have that.
Yeah, well, how many of us have been booed by thousands of people at the same time?
Think about Charles Smith, 30 years later, still will not do certain interviews. Like, he still gets it 30 years later. And by all accounts, is, everyone says, a wonderful man, like, you know, respected. He has been, you think of people like Bill Buckner.
I was just thinking about him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, what would help is if people are willing to think a little bit deep. And I think a lot of times people don't want to go that deep about, something I said earlier about that these are human beings. This is a human relations thing, and how we deal. All people hurt emotionally, physically, and some people are more exposed, and some people, as you were saying before, get a level of humiliation, harassment that none of us could ever imagine. I mean, I would hate to be, reading the paper and having some smart aleck sports reporter like making all kinds of negative comments about me in very witty ways, but very hurtful ways. You think about that and how the families are affected. And I mean, there is a lot of glory. Excuse me?
I don't want to make it about the children. And this is a reality. If you work in front of 20,000 people, then you bring your kids to a game. It could happen, but it's happened. And it's very hard to be watching at home and knowing that at the time, I think 4 or 5 year old son is in an arena. He's old enough to understand that 20,000 people are booing his father. I don't expect 20,000 people to behave according to Julius Randle's kids. But again, it's just one of those, you never have to think about this.
Right.
Ever.
Right. It's messy sometimes.
Now, I don't know if this goes along with that or if it matters again, but this is, we're going to stop soon. So we'll keep this very, very, very short because this could become another hour by itself. But the flips, I would say as a fan and a fan that I try to be, I enjoy the humanity of sports. I would rather see the Knicks. I'm so compelled by Randle as a human and I like him so much that just like I wouldn't trade stars for Jordan, I want to see where things go. Let him be here the next 3 to 5 years. I want to see his story, not just how does the team do with him, but that much level of just, I think that would be interesting.
Yeah. They'll toss him.
Exactly. Now here's the thing. If I'm going to take that perspective of I'm not just here for the sports. There's a large, we're all humans.
Bigger picture, right.
Then there are always players on the team who, this person was, Derrick Rose was accused of sexual assault, goes to a civil trial. Now this gets really awkward. Derrick Rose is beloved as a player, as a person, as a figure. Like everyone who talks about Derrick Rose and the vibe you get from him is that seems like a cool. But when you read some of the testimony from the trial and some of what he had to say about, consent and men and blah, blah, blah. Or there's a player the Knicks drafted, about 5 years ago, maybe Damian Dotson. When Dotson was in college, he was one of three players charged with raping a student. They weren't charged and then he transferred. Point being, I don't mean to isolate Rose and Dotson, but the point is if my core approach is I care about the humanity. So give me the humanity and give me people struggling, even as humans. I get very stuck, and it's not the same between actors and musicians and athletes. It's not the same for me between them. Some people do something and it's all right, I'm never watching a movie that person does. I don't stop watching the Knicks because they sign people who have done. Anthony Mason was charged with statutory rape in the time that he was in it. Charles Oakley, famously, people laugh about it. Charles Oakley knocked someone out before a game. He slapped a guy because he owed him money. Charles Oakley assaulted people. Stephon Marbury got in a van with a Knick intern and basically pressured her into having sex with him. We can go on and on and on and on. Just on a human level, I struggle with where do I say, give me your Randles. Does that mean give me everybody? Or does it,
That's a good question. I mean, I guess
you answer it in the next 30 seconds.
Okay, maybe you say.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm saying, like, I think we could talk about that for an hour.
Right. Right.
You know. But what do you think? I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, maybe, you know, a simple answer is, again, it's not always black and white, but if you're dealing with someone who has not hurt other people, it's one thing. If it's someone who has violated another person or has assaulted another person and somehow it's determined that they were the aggressor in that, that's a little bit different than someone who may have be struggling with other kinds of demons within and they haven't caused something. You know, I think that's a little bit different. But again, it's a question, you know, this is a big business, a lot of money. And I think that's another discussion. I think money sometimes puts different lenses on us in terms of the kinds of decisions we make. And I have no idea of what it will be like to be sitting at a desk making decisions about hiring some terrific ball player that I know if we get him, it's going to increase our revenue by millions and millions and millions. And that's what I've been hired to do. So it's, you know, moral dilemmas, and moral dilemmas are always a challenge.
It's a challenge to wrap up this episode, but I'm going to have to. So,
okay. Well,
I want to thank you again for being on the
show. Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll have to do it again sometime.
And then one day, you know, if you bring me back, I could talk about the dead spots on the Madison Square Garden, floor.
Well, look, a lot of those Knicks are getting up around that 80-year-old age, so I'm sure we will have an opportunity sooner than not to have that conversation. So I want to remind our listeners, Knicks' next game is Monday. They host the Houston Rockets that day. I will be in attendance, so if you have ever wanted to hand me cash in person, this is your opportunity. Stacy should be back with us, I think,
next episode. Soupy Sales got in trouble for that.
Who did?
Soupy Sales.
Soupy Sales?
Yeah,
got our first Soupy Sales mention on the pod. This is exciting.
Don't ask your listeners to send you money, man. Don't go there. Listen to your father.
The Believe Knicks podcast, as always, is presented by Bet Online. It's also presented by me and today my father. That's it for this episode, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.